Okay. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for being accommodating and allowing me to change the time this time. I hope it didn't inconvenience too many people, although I see there are fewer people, but they can watch the video. Okay, so today we are going to go to Akko. Hey, why Akko? So there's a lot of interesting things to talk about in Akko. Of course, we're going to talk about Bate Knesset there, but we're also going to take advantage of heading there in order to see the city, hear the story of the city, of the antiquities there. Akko is an unusual place in that it's sort of in the land of Israel, but it's also in Chutz Laaretz, right? And we're going to see that both in a halachic sense, as well as in the sense of just the feeling of it, right? That there are always visitors coming in, that there's a port there. Okay, so it's a fascinating place. It's got centuries upon centuries of history here. There's always contact with the diaspora. Some people think of Akko as a very non-Jewish city, and there definitely is a strong crusader history here. But ironically, the Crusaders coming here actually opened up the land of Israel for many Jewish travelers. So that's just an interesting, ironic story of the facilitating of Aliyah by the Crusaders, who I'm sure had nothing of the sort in mind. It's also a place that has a lot of messianic hopes because there are great empires that have fought here, whether it was the Crusaders against the Muslims, the Ottomans against Napoleon, right? So there's always this feeling of like Gog and Magog, Armageddon happening here. So we're going to explore that and the various visitors to the city, but we're also going to connect back to our themes of the Bate Knesset. And here we're going to take this week, we're going to take the opportunity to examine women in the synagogue. Women in terms of, are women obligated in prayer? Women in terms of, did women actually come to the synagogue in ancient times? We're not going to go into modern times, but that's an interesting question in and of itself. In modern Europe or the Arab countries, modern meaning 19th, 20th century. And we're also going to look at the idea of a women's section, right? And did that
Excellent.
exist in ancient synagogues? So that's our focus. Why here in Akko? Because I'm hanging it. It's a little bit hanging by a thread, but you'll forgive me. Okay. We have two very interesting Bate Knesset in Akko. We're going to look at both of them. One is rather old, 18th century. We're not talking ancient. The one goes back to the 18th century, and that's the Beit Knesset of the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato. We're going to talk about him. And his Beit Knesset did not have a women's section. Okay, so that's whether that's for Kabbalistic reasons or practical space reasons is an interesting possibility. We don't really know, but that was a good way to take a look at women. Did they come to the synagogue or not? And the other synagogue, which is very modern, 20th century synagogue, which is phenomenal. And if you have a chance to be in Israel or you live in Israel, definitely worth a visit. And that's the Tunisian synagogue and the mosaics there. We're going to look at that at the very end. And the connection there is that the women's section in the Tunisian synagogue, big, beautiful women's section that is decorated like the entire place with mosaics, but the women's section is decorated only with mosaics about women of Tanakh, right? So that's just a beautiful focus on women in the women's section. We're talking about the Imahot, of course, but we're also talking about Ruth and Esther and Yocheved, right? And it's really beautiful and very, very worth seeing. So let us get started with Akko and our themes. So as we said, in-depth tour of Akko and its synagogues, as well as a focus on women and different connections of women to the Bate Knesset. Where are we in Akko? Okay, we are all the way up the coast. Okay, not quite at the end, not quite at the edge of the country by Lebanon, but very close to it. We're going to talk about Akko, whether it's included halachically in the definition of the land of Israel, of Eretz Yisrael. And part of that is because right above Nahariya, which I did not include in my little satellite photo here, but right above here is a place called Rosh HaNikra, which is the natural border along the coast. So we're going to talk about that. It's on major roads. And what's important is that it's got this nice protected, and this is why you have this nice satellite picture, have this nice protected bay. Okay, this bay, which actually starts in Haifa, right, goes up to Akko, and it means that this whole area is very good for ports, right? It's very good for a port. A port needs to be with a protected area. Haifa today is one of the major ports of Israel. Akko, not anymore. There are still boats that come into Akko, but basically they're like touring boats. It's definitely not a big enough port for the massive ships of today, but for the last, give or take, 2,200 years, it was perfectly useful as a port. So it means it was a very wealthy trading city because ships are coming in and out. So that's just to give us a sense of where we are. Also, we are in the north, which we know is important for Jews after the destruction of the Second Temple. Jews move up to the north, but it's on the coast, and the coast has always been traditionally up until the last 150 years, the coast has been the area of the non-Jews, right? Phoenicians, Greeks, Crusaders, etc. So while we're in an area that became heavily Jewish in Mishnaic times and in Talmudic times, it's also an area that did not have Jews traditionally. But we're going to see that there were definitely Jews in Akko. Okay, so that's just to give us a little bit of where we are. Now let's take a look at when we are. Okay, so don't get scared by this very long timeline. It just means that Akko had many time periods that were important. By the way, I noticed Maya put in the chat already the sources. So if you don't have the sources in front of you, scroll back to the very beginning of the chat and you have them. And then you can have this timeline to look at your leisure, because I know this is what everybody's going to be doing tonight for their entertainment, is looking at the timeline. Okay, so Akko goes back very far. It is a very old city, okay? But what's fascinating about it is, like the other cities on the coast, like Caesarea, like Jaffa, like Ashkelon, it has approximately 400 to 500 years, and take a look down here and you'll see what I'm talking about, 400 to 500 years where it is uninhabited, okay? And that's our story of the Mamluk destruction of the coast, only rebuilt later in Ottoman times. But with that said, Akko goes back very far, right? Goes back to the early Bronze Age, 3000 BCE, an important Canaanite city. We'll see where the city is at different time periods. Okay, in an Egyptian city conquered by Paro Tutmos, given to King Solomon. Okay, but in reality, even though Tanakh talks about Hiram Melech Tzor, Hiram the king of Tyre, Akko is very close to Tzor and Sidon. It's basically, we'll see, part of the Phoenician kingdom. So even though Tanakh talks about Hiram giving Akko to King Solomon, in reality, the Phoenicians are the guys who are ruling here, okay? And we'll get to the Phoenicians, who are fascinating people. By 500 before the Common Era, the city expands. It doesn't begin near the water, but by 500, it expands to the harbor area. It becomes a Hellenistic city with an important harbor and a mint, okay? It's an important Roman city during the Great Revolt. And even though there are Jews living here, they are turned on by their fellow citizens. And we have this story. Josephus tells us similar things about Beit Sha'an, about Ashkelon, that are primarily non-Jewish. And during the revolt, the Roman city citizens, the Hellenized citizens of the city, turn on the Jews. And we have that here in Akko as well. However, the Jewish community of Akko gets itself back on its feet. And from the second to the sixth centuries, we have significant Jewish and Christian communities in Akko. And we have rabbis that come from Akko. The city is conquered by the Muslims, ruled by the Muslims for over 400 years, okay, and then conquered by the Crusaders. And then we have this kind of ping pong back and forth. The Crusaders conquer it. It's recaptured by the Muslims, by Salah ad-Din. Richard the Lionheart comes back. Akko becomes the capital of the Second Crusader Kingdom, right? The Crusader kingdom post Salahuddin, and it becomes a very, very important city that, despite its Christian origins, has many Jewish visitors, very important Jewish visitors, like Maimonides, like Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, and we'll come to that. But all of this comes to a very dramatic end. 1291, the Mamluks, the Muslims, conquer the city, destroy the city, and that is the end of Akko for the next 400 years. For the next 400 years, the city is renewed by the Ottomans. There are Jews that come back. Whoever is not muted, please mute yourselves. Maybe Maya, can you mute everybody? Oh, here I see. Okay, I will mute. The city is rebuilt by the Ottomans. Almost conquered by Napoleon, but he's defeated. We have another interesting Jewish visitor, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, comes to Akko. Okay. Then we have the Ottomans ruling, the prison of the Ottomans, the British who are here, the Akko prison break. So you can see we have quite a lot of Jewish history going on in Akko in between all of these conquerors and rulers. 1948, the State of Israel conquers Akko. Today there are 49,000 residents, two-thirds of whom are Jewish, one-third of whom are Arabs. Okay, so let's just keep all those things in mind. And essentially what we're going to see, and this is very important to understand, is that there are two cities. There is the Ottoman city, and it is built on top of the Crusader city. What does that mean? We will see in pictures. Hopefully it will all become clear. But that's just to give us a basic outline of the timeline. Okay, we're cutting back and forth between our Akko and our women. So let's take a look at women for a moment. Okay, and women and prayer. This is obviously a subject for an entire class, and I am not the one to give that class. Ask Rabbi Kalman, arrange a Torah in Motion class. I'm sure you could have one, or if you have not had already. But women in prayer, are women obligated in prayer? And we're just going to look at the major opinions here. The Mishnah in Brachot, right, says something very interesting, seemingly slightly contradictory, right? Women, slaves, and minors, right? Nashim, avadim, ktanim, they are the troika that always go together in halacha. All people who are considered halachically to not be completely in control of their own destiny, okay? That's the halachic idea behind it, that women are controlled by their husbands, slaves are controlled by their masters, and children are controlled by their parents. Whether this is actually true for any of the three is debatable, but that's the halachic conception here. Women, slaves, and minors are exempt from the recitation of Shema and from phylacteries, from tefillin. Why? Okay, the Gemara and the commentaries explain, because these are considered time-bound mitzvot. Mitzvot aseh shehazman gramai, and if you don't have your own time in your own hands, you are not obligated in time-bound mitzvot. Fine, we understand that. But are obligated in prayer, mezuzah, and birkat hamazon, and grace after meals. Now, what is prayer mean here? Okay, what does prayer mean here? And don't even try to hold me to mitzvot aseh shehazman gramai and give me exceptions here or there. Like I said, this is really a whole class. We're going to kind of look at the bigger picture. But what does prayer mean in this context? Tefillah, right? Tefillah as opposed to Shema. So tefillah seems to mean the Amidah, seems to mean the Shemona Esrei, but you still have to understand, what are women obligated? Are they obligated to say Shemona Esrei three times a day, or are they merely obligated to pray in some way? And this is where you get to a big argument between the Rambam, between Maimonides and the Ramban. And the Halakha, by the way, we are mostly posek according to the Ramban, that women do have to pray, although there are exceptions because women who are with small children at home, right? And like I said, I'm not going to go into it deeply, but let's take a look at what the Rambam says. Hey, the Rambam, Hilchot Tefillah, to pray daily is an affirmative duty, right? Mitzvat Aseh. As it is said, you shall serve the Lord your God. The service is according to the tradition is prayer, right? Tefillah. What avodah hi tefillah. Right, avodai tefillah shabalev. Right, what is service of the heart? Prayer. The number of prayers is not prescribed in the Torah. No form of prayer is prescribed in the Torah, nor does the Torah prescribe a fixed time for prayer. Okay, so the Rambam is setting up something very important. He's saying the the mitzvah of prayer is de'oraita. It is a Torah obligation. What is that Torah obligation? It's not with a fixed time or a fixed number of prayers. And that's why women are obligated. What that means is women are not obligated in those three tefillot in any particular prayer. What do they have to say? Hence, the next Mishnah, the next halacha, women and slaves are under an obligation to pray, this being a duty, the fulfillment of which is independent of set periods. The obligation in this precept is that every person should daily, according to his ability, offer up supplication and prayer, uttering praises of God, supplication, petition, praise, and thanksgiving, right? The Rambam sets up a structure that women have to follow, right? You have to have shevach, right? You have to praise God. You have to have a bakasha. You have to ask God for things. And you have to have, again, another shevach. You have to have a thanks to God. So he's giving something of a structure, but that structure is not the Shmona Esrei, and it's not the Birchot HaShachar, Psukei Dezimra, right, what we think of, but rather you can say your own prayer. And many women throughout the centuries relied on this and said, there they woke up, they said Modani, they said thank you to God, they offered a prayer that their children should be healthy, and then they said thank you to God again, and that was considered prayer. According to the Rambam, you are fulfilling your responsibility according to the Torah with such a prayer, right? Does it mean you should say Birkot HaTorah, right? Different poskim have talked about this, but that's the Rambam, that you don't need to say set prayers, but you do need to have every day some kind of a bakasha. Okay, take a look at the Mishnah Berurah. Sorry, I brought it only in Hebrew, but we will translate as we go along. Hey, the Mishnah Berurah commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, who goes in the Sephardi direction following the Rambam, saying women are obligated in prayer, but not in fixed prayer like we know. Okay, calls it Lidat HaRambam. The times of prayer, the set prayer is from the rabbis, but the actual mitzvah of prayer is from the Torah, right? And then he quotes the Rambam, etc., etc. Okay, she'd palel pam achad bayom o balayla, yitzei yidei chova min haTorah. If you pray once during the day or the night, you are fulfilling your obligation from the Torah. Okay, v'katava magen Avram, we're on end of line three here, sh'af al pi Farazo nahagu ropa nashim shein mitpalim yudchet bi'ibet midut shachar ba'erev. The Magen Avraham says most women did not pray the Amida, the Shmoneh Esrei, in the morning and the evening. The Fisher Amrat miyad boboker samuch netila eze bakasha. Right, it's what we said. They woke up in the morning, they washed their hands, they said some kind of a supplication. Umina Torah yotzot bezeh. And from the Torah obligation, they have now fulfilled that Torah obligation. And even the rabbis may have not wanted more. Aval, and here's where we get to the difference of opinion. Dat Haramban, the Ramban, Nachmanides, changes the idea here. He doesn't agree with the Rambam. Sheikar mitzvat tefila hi midivrei sofrim shehem anshei Knesset hagdola shetiknu yudchet brachot al seder litpalel otan shacharit umincha chova varvit rishut. The main mitzvah of prayer, according to the Ramban, is rabbinic, right? Is midivrei sofrim. And they arrange that you have to say Shmoneh Esrei twice, Shacharit and Mincha, and then Maariv is a Rishut. Ba'af al pi shehu mitzvah taseh midivrei sofrim shazman grama, and even though it's a rabbinical precept that is time-bound, v'hanashim pturot mikol mitzvah taseh shazman grama, and women are not obligated in time-bound mitzvot, afil midivrei sofrim kegon kiddush ha-levana, right? They don't have to do things like kiddush levana. Af al pi kein chivu otam b'tfilat shacharit u'mincha kmo anashim. Even so, they are required to say shacharit and mincha, regular amida prayer, like men. Why? Ho'il v'tfila hi bakashat rachamim. Women, like men, need mercy from God. And therefore, even though it's a time-bound mitzvah, right, you have to still say it because you need to have mercy from God. And that's the Ramban's approach. And most modern poskim will go according to Ramban, say women are obligated in Shacharit and Mincha, Shmoneh Esrei. And again, this changes women who have children at home, women who aren't yet married, women whose children are grown, etc. All of those are different. And the situation of women today is so different than from the time of the Mishnah that it definitely makes sense that at large portions of women's lives, they are obligated in Tefillah. But you do have this very basic distinction between the Rambam, a general need to approach God at some point during the day, and the Ramban who says, no, it has to be a formal prayer twice a day. The third tefillah is reshut. Men accepted it upon themselves. Women don't necessarily have to. Okay, so you have this definite distinction between the two, and right, yet there's zil gemor. There's always more to learn about this, but this is just to give you a concept. Let's go back to Akko, okay? And we'll come back to our women. Don't worry, we're not going to leave them behind. Okay, Akko begins in the Tell. It's a little bit counterintuitive, right? Akko starts inland. You would really have thought that the city would begin by the water, but it does not. The oldest portions of the city are inside, not very far, right? It's not a very long distance. If you're driving, it's about a 10-minute drive from Tell Akko to the sea. But this is where the city begins. And it's only in Hellenistic times, right? 4th-3rd century before the Common Era, that the city expands all the way out here to the harbor, and at that point the city stays all the way over here. You have a lot of fascinating midrashim about Akko. The rabbis are clearly familiar with Akko. They do a midrash shemot. They take the name of Akko and they say, what does that word mean? Akko, it means adko, up until here, meaning there was the flood, right? It was raining in the time of Noah, and the flood and the water came, rose until it got to Akko. Adko, it stopped and there was no more water here, right? It's a great midrash shemot. The midrashim talk about how the fish taste different all over the world, and fish from Akko, right, don't taste the same as fish from other places. Really, where does the name come from? It probably comes from the Greek, right? The word Akko sounds like the Greek word Akka, healer. And there's a belief, there's a Greek myth that Hercules is bitten by the Hydra and he's cured by water from Nahal Naaman, which is the local spring. Okay. So Akko, Acker, A-C-R-E is the English spelling, it's the English pronunciation, but in Hebrew and presumably in Greek, right? It's Akko. So the city moves, okay? This is the Tell, well, this is really Tell Napoleon. You can see it says Tell Napoleon over here, but it's right near Tell Akko. Always very strange. Israel is very strange about things like this. We have this statue on top of this Tell, which is where Napoleon gathered his forces, where people gathered their forces to fight against Napoleon. We're commemorating it by this statue of a horse up here, right? If we want to look at Akko in the time of Tanakh, Akko is in the Nahala, is in the portion of Asher. Okay. The blessing of Asher in Sefer Dvarim is Barzel Unechoshet Manulecha, okay? You are locked by, you use locks of copper and of iron. And the Ramban comments, the Ramban who came to Akko, right? He says, Akko is the Manul, is the lock of the land of Israel, protects it from invaders. Okay? We have another synagogue in Akko. We don't really have a synagogue. We have a sign that talks about a synagogue that may have been there at one point, but it's a very strange name. It's called Beit Knesset Achav, right? Ahab, remember him, the king in the time of Eliyahu, not exactly the guy that you could imagine as being the 10th guy to make up a minion, but there's a synagogue named for him, traditionally, you know, the place that he went to. Why Achav? What's Achav doing in Akko? Well, Achav marries Jezebel, Izebel, right, who comes from Lebanon, right, who comes from Tsor and Sidon. So there is that definite connection to here, and the tribe of Asher is very, very close to the Phoenicians, to Tsor and Sidon, and that brings us to who are the Phoenicians, right? So the Phoenicians are fascinating people. They're really Canaanites, right? They're up here, Sidon and Tyre and other places, but they're ethnically and religiously and linguistically the same as the Canaanites in the rest of Canaan. In Tanakh, they are seen as the ultimate traitors, okay? Traitors with a D, not traitors with a T. They are not conquerors. We don't hear about the Phoenicians attacking and conquering. They conquer through trade. And ultimately, they're great sailors, right? They're living on the coast. And ultimately, they expand their empire through trade, spreading all the way down the coast of the land of Israel. We know we have Phoenician outposts in Ashkelon and inland as well. And ultimately, they make it all the way across the Mediterranean to have all these colonies in North Africa. And when we talk about the city of Carthage, right, we have these great wars in Roman times, the Punic Wars. Punic is Phoenician. This is the Phoenicians. And they're the ones who are fighting the Romans. So they are really colonizing through trade. And when we talk about Ahav and Izebel, right, Ahav marries Izebel. I highly doubt it was a great love match. That might have, who knows, but he's marrying her because she's a great trade connection, right? If you have this connection to the Phoenicians, that's great for the economy. You're going to have all these great trade connections, and you'll be able to make all kinds of money. And Ahav, as a king, is very successful. As a Jew, not particularly, but as a king, he's very, very successful. And part of that is these economic connections that he makes. Okay, so a little bit, just one more thing about, two more things about the Phoenicians, because they provide two very, very important commodities in ancient Israel. Okay, one is the purple, the Tyrian purple. Okay, Phoenicia, the word Phoenicia actually means purple in Greek, and the Phoenicians were famous for the production of this dye that comes from the Murex snails, and that we as Jews know of, not because of purple, I made my background purple for the PowerPoint because of it, okay, but because of the tchelet, right, the blue that we use in the tzitzit comes from the same dye, the same murex snails, only with a chemical process done to it to make it from purple into this beautiful, beautiful blue. And we know, right, the Gemara in Shabbos talks about the yogvim, who are the tzayadei chilazon, the hunters of the snails, misulama shel tzor ad chefa, where are the snails being captured, being netted, right, from the area of Rosh HaNikra until Haifa. So this is the place where these snails really, really live, and this is where they're captured, and the Phoenicians are the ones who come up with this brilliant technology to create the dye. Very, very, very important in ancient times. The other thing that comes from Tsor is Tyrian silver. There's a mint in Tyre, in Tsor, and the Gemara talks about the half shekel, right, and machatzita shekel. And it says, ein kesef b'kol makom, eino ela kesef tzori. Okay. Anytime that we talk about silver and giving silver, for example, to the Beit HaMikdash, we are talking about silver that comes from the Tyrian mint, because they are considered to have the best coins. Mints were known to be good or bad. Some mints really had very adulterated coins, and they didn't have as much metal in their coins. It wasn't a standard. And the Tyrian mint was known to be of a very, very high standard. And therefore, the rabbis say, when you're giving your half shekel coin to the mikdash, it has to be the half shekel that comes from the Tyrian mint, which is what this is. That's what it looks like. And that's another thing that the Phoenicians are very famous for. Okay, back to Akko. In Hellenistic times, by the 3rd century of the before the Common Era, the city has expanded to the sea. The harbor was just recently discovered, just a few years ago, doing underwater archaeology. They actually discovered the remains of the harbor. So far, it's the largest Hellenistic harbor that's ever been discovered in the land of Israel. So that's a pretty cool thing. And it's just an example of what will come, meaning Akko is poised to become a place of great trade and great travel back and forth, which brings us to our next question, which is, Akko is inside the land or it's outside the land, right? Coming into the land of Israel, have you reached the land when you come to Akko or not? So you are on a main road, right? Let's just look at the map for a moment over here on the right. Okay. So we have what we call the Via Maris, right? The Derech Hayam, which we've talked about many, many times. Okay. The road that comes up the coast, goes a little inland because of swamps and various other things, crosses over by the Jezreel Valley and heads out to the northeast. But there's another branch that continues straight north, right? And it goes up the coast and it passes Akko. Okay. So you are definitely able to leave the land by way of Akko, but is it included in the land or is it not? Is it part of the land or not? So we have various landmarks, right? We have, Sulam HaShaltzor, which is what the rabbis call Rosh HaNikra, right? Rosh HaNikra is a natural border, right? It's this huge rock formation on the border, right? Just a little bit north of Akko over here. And the rabbis are very clear what it is. When you reach Sulam HaShaltzor, the ladder of Tyre, okay, you're entering into the land of Israel. They have this great medrash that talks about how, Abraham gets to Sulam HaShaltzor and he sees that the people are different. This is a good place to be, right? We also hear in the Gemara all about rabbis traveling and they go past. They could go to Babylonia on this, you know, northeastern road, but they could also go the other way, straight up, and they pass by Sulam HaShaltzor, and we hear about that. So when you pass Rosh HaNikra, are you in the land of Israel? So we have one example that would seem very, very obvious, right? This source here in the Yerushalmi, Shvi'it, Rabbi Yossi ben Chanina would kiss the rocks of Akko and say, till here is the land of Israel. Clear, but not so clear, meaning till here, ad bichlal, ad below ad bichlal, is Akko in the land? Is it not in the land? Rather confusing. So really it depends on for what. It depends on the circumstances. A very, very famous and important halachic example of the borders of the land of Israel. You might think the most important thing is Shemitah, right? Mitzvot Atzliyot Baretz, but not only. And we have very important laws about get, right? About divorce bill. If a divorce comes from outside of the land of Israel, from what's called Medinat Hayam, right? Abroad, it has different rules than if it is written in the land of Israel. If it's coming from far away, you have to have more testimony about it because it might be suspect. So you have here in the very beginning of the Mishnah of Gittin, starting out the first laws, if one delivers a get from abroad, from Medinat Hayam, he must affirm that it was written and sealed in his presence. Bifanai nichtav ubifanai nichtam. Right? The husband is not bringing it. It's a messenger who's bringing it. And he has to give very clear testimony that I was there when the husband wrote it out. It was sealed up. Nobody's tampered with it. Okay. Very nice. But what are the borders of this Medinat Hayam, right? Where does Medinat Hayam begin? Rabbi Yehuda says from Rechem to the east. Rechem is the area of Tveria. And Rechem is like the east from Ashkelon to the south. And Ashkelon is like the south from Akko to the north. And Akko is like the north, meaning Akko is outside of the land of Israel. Rabbi Meir says, no, Akko is considered the land of Israel for a get. So Akko has this strange position of being in the land, outside the land, depends on who you ask, depends on what the circumstances are. It definitely is a place that with its face towards Chutzlaretz, right? It's always looking and bringing in people. And this is the first entrance to the land for many people. So it definitely has a deep connection to outside of the land of Israel. Okay. So where are we going to be in Akko when we travel around and take a look at some of the things, right? So let's just point out a couple of places quickly, right? The walls around the city, which are mostly the Ottoman walls rebuilt on top of the Crusader walls, right? So the walls around the city, the ancient port, okay? The citadel and the area of the Hospitallers of the Crusaders with the Ottoman prison on top, very important. Okay, where is our Ramchal synagogue? Over here. Also, this is all the old city. This is not the new city. This is all the old city. Ramchal, deep in the alleyways of the Shuk of the old city. The Templar Tunnel, we'll mention a little bit. The Tunisian Shul is outside, right? Tunisian Shul is not in the old city. It's outside the old city, in this direction. So therefore not on this map, but these are the things we're going to be pointing out in the old city itself. Okay. Now the fascinating thing about Akko, and this is what I mentioned before, is that it is two cities, one above the other. Okay? When the Mamluks come at the end of the 13th century, they destroy the Crusader city. Okay? This is the decision of Baibars, the Mamluk conqueror, who says, I don't want any more Crusaders coming and attacking. We had, 200 years more, right? 200 years, yeah, less, a little less than 200 years of Crusaders coming and taking over in the land of Israel. Enough. We don't want any more invasions from the sea. And so what he does is he systematically destroys the cities on the coast, Ashkelon, Jaffa, Caesarea, Atlit, and Akko. And these cities, and he destroys them. He destroys these massive buildings, and nobody comes and builds on top of them. Now, 450 years later, along come the Ottomans. They want the cities on the coast. The cities on the coast, this is a great advantage to have cities on the coast. And they want to rebuild them. But what can we do? No bulldozers in the 18th century. So what do? You have to build on top of these massive, massive Crusader structures. So what they do is they build huge arches, okay? And then they build on top, and there's 12 meters, 36 feet between the Ottoman city and the Crusader city, which is really an amazing thing. Take a look. This is a crazy picture, okay? Take a look at the picture here on the left. Okay, this is the area of the Hospitallers, of the prison on top. Okay, you can see it here. Let's do this better. Okay, this is the area of the Ottoman prison. Okay, and this is in the 1938. Okay, this is that area today. Okay, you could see the mosque peeking out. And this is the whole area below that was dug out starting in the 50s, but mostly in the 90s, in the 2000s, dug out this incredible, incredible Crusader complex that was essentially very preserved underground. Take a look here. In the 1950s, Israel wanted to start excavating here, and it actually, the UN wanted to create various UNESCO World Heritage Sites in the land of Israel, and they were debating what to have as the Christian World Heritage Site. They wanted to have a Jewish and a Christian and a Nabataean, right? Rather strange combination. And the American ambassador, a guy named Lessen, came to the land of Israel, and he was brought to Akko to see the potential. And he essentially is like crawling through these narrow, narrow tunnels to see what there is, because there was nothing that was excavated. And he's kind of blown away, and they give the money to excavate, but it took a very, very long time. Today, much of the city is excavated. A lot is not, by the way, but much of it is. Okay. And certainly this area, which is called the Hospitaller area, the Hospitallers were, Crusader order, an order of knights that ran hospitals, right? They took care of sick people. Their patron saint was John the Baptist, Jean of Akko. Okay. That's what they call themselves, right? They are the Order of Jean of Akko. And they have these incredible halls and a hospital and a dining hall and a dungeon and everything that you might possibly need. The model over here on the right, shows you all of these various buildings. And what's interesting is that what the Crusaders did in Akko is what they did in other places as well. For example, in Belvoir, Kochav HaYarden, right? Or in Yechiam, or in all the places where they built fortresses on top of mountains. The only difference is here, this is a fortress, but inside a city, Okay, they had the same kind of a structure, but inside the city itself, including secret underground escape tunnels, right? This is not the Hospitallers. This is the Templars. They built a tunnel that's 350 meters long from their fortress to the port in case they needed to escape. Didn't ultimately help them so much. They built toilets and a whole sewer system that was just discovered. Okay. It was discovered very recently, and they actually put dyed water. They poured dyed water down these toilets. Can you see the toilets here? Always happy when we discovered toilets. They put dyed water down into the toilets to see where it ended up, and it actually goes all the way out to the port. So it's really a very, very sophisticated system. The Crusaders, what happens is you have many, many different groups of Crusaders who are in the city, and this is just a map to give you a little bit of a sense. You have the Hospitallers, you have the Templars, you have the Alemannia, right? The Germans, you have the Venetians, you have all different groups. The city is really divided up, cities within cities, not all of them really like each other. Okay. The story with the Crusaders is basically a two-part story. Okay. It's originally conquered. In the First Crusade, it becomes an important city, but in 1191, along comes Salah ad-Din, the Muslim conqueror, gets rid of the Crusaders, okay? But very, very soon afterwards, along comes Richard the Lionhearted. He retakes Akko. However, he's not able to take Jerusalem. And so the last 100 years, right, of the Crusader kingdom, the second 100 years, let's say the second half of the Crusader kingdom, you have the Kingdom of Jerusalem, whose capital is Akko. They don't have Jerusalem, but they call Akko the capital of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. It's rather strange, right? And Akko is this fascinating place. On the one hand, it's a crusader town with all these different types of people. It's a trade powerhouse. It's very important to Christians. On the other hand, it's very pluralistic, which is very weird, right, for a crusader city. But the Crusader knights who come here, they have to marry somebody. So they marry the local Arab women. And because they come and trade is opened up, Jews start to come. And you have this very mixed community. Hey, we have this great testimony from the Bishop of Akko, Jacques de Vitry, who's very, very disturbed by everything that's going on here. He talks about the mixed marriages and the mixed children. He says there's prostitution and there's adultery and there's murder, and he's not happy. But ironically, it means that a lot of Jews can come to Akko and can come to the land of Israel. Now, this does not mean the Crusader time period was not a disaster for Jews. It was a disaster for Jews. But the aftermath of the Crusaders, the second part of their being here, means that it's easier to come to the land of Israel. So more and more Jews do. And we hear about Maimonides. We're going to read his testimony in a minute. We hear about the Ramban, Nachmanides, who moves to Jerusalem, but then he goes to Akko for the end of his life. We hear about 300 rabbis from Ashkenaz, from Germany and France, who come and make Aliyah and settle in Akko. Rabbi Yechiel of Paris comes, he makes a yeshiva in Akko, right? Everybody is thinking it's the time of the Geula. Why? Because you have these great battles between the Crusaders, the Christians, and the Muslims, right? Gog and Magog. You also have the year 1240, which is the beginning of the sixth millennium, right? A lot of eschatological ideas connected to that. So you have suddenly all of these Jews coming back to the land through Crusader Akko. So just to read the testimony of the Rambam, it's great. He comes on 1165. Now, he doesn't stay in the land of Israel. As we know, the Rambam makes his home in Egypt. He's not able to stay in the land of Israel, but he does come to the land of Israel, right? And this is on his journey from North Africa. On the first day of the week, on the third day of Sivan, I safely left the sea. I came to Akko and was saved from apostasy, right? He has to flee North Africa. He has to flee Morocco because the Muslims are forcing everyone to convert. And I arrived in the land of Israel, and I vowed that this day would be one of happiness and joy, feasting and giving gifts to the poor, for myself and my household forever. On the third day of the week, on the fourth of Marcheshvan, in the year 4726, we left Akko to go to Jerusalem, right? He enters the great and holy house. Very interesting. Does he go up on Harabai, right? That's for a Jerusalem class. And then the next week, right, I left Jerusalem and traveled to Hebron to kiss the graves of my fathers in the cave of Machpelah. And that day I stood and prayed, thank God for everything. And these 2 days, the sixth and the ninth of Mar Cheshvan, I vowed would be holidays for me, right? Very beautiful testimony of him coming to Akko. We know the Ramban goes to Akko, but I brought here his commentary, which I think is beautiful because he actually comes and he sees these places, right? We have the verse in Vayikra, where this is part of the curses, right? God's curses on the land. I will bring the land into desolation. Your enemies as well shall be astonished at it, right? And what does the Ramban say? These words promise redemption more than any of the visions of Daniel. When it says your versions will, enemies will be astonished by it, this is good news, informing us that our land cannot accept our enemies. And this is a great proof and promise because you cannot find another land as fertile and prosperous that is now so destroyed. Because since we have left, it has not accepted any nation or language and all try to settle it and cannot succeed. And the Ramban is an eyewitness. He comes, he sees the land of Israel. So Jews start to come back. Akko is flourishing as a very multicultural city. All of this comes crashing down in 1291. The Crusaders are vanquished by the Mamluks. Akko is destroyed. We have all kinds of testimony to this, but this is a very interesting testimony. In 2017, a shipwreck was discovered in the Haifa Bay. And on the ship were these gold florins. Okay? They were minted after 1252. And the suggestion is that maybe this was a ship that was carrying desperate crusaders who were fleeing Akko ahead of the Mamluk invaders, took their treasure with them. Unfortunately, the ship was wrecked. Did any of them survive? We have no way of knowing. The city sits empty for a long time. It's rebuilt in the 18th century by a Bedouin ruler named Dar el Omar, who rebuilds a lot of the north, including Tveria, including Akko. He builds these arches, fills in the Crusader area, builds on top. Most of the seawalls that we see today are Ottoman, are from the time of Dar el Omar. He has no problem with Christians and Jews coming and rebuilding the city. Adraba, he wants them to help build the economy, and the city starts to grow. And one of the people who comes back to this renewed Akko is one of the most fascinating early modern thinkers, and this is the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato. The Ramchal lives a very short life. And in his very short life, he accomplishes more than most people accomplish in long lives. He's a real Renaissance man. He's a Kabbalist and he's a poet and he's a Musar man, right? Before the Musar movement begins, but one of the greatest works of ethics and of how to behave is the Mesilat Yesharim, is the Path of the Just that we're going to read a little bit of now. He knows Italian culture inside out. He knows Jewish culture inside out. He writes secular and religious poetry. He's an unbelievable person who is persecuted his whole life. Okay? He's suspected of being a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. He has to flee from Padua in Amsterdam. He has to go to Padua in Italy. He has to go to Amsterdam. From Amsterdam, he has to flee and go to Akko. He comes to Akko in 1743. He lives here for 3 very short years, and then he dies in a plague. And he, in his lifetime, gets no respect. Nobody is interested in him. After his death, everybody wants him. Everybody. The Hasidim are very taken by him, and the Misnagdim are very taken by him, and the people who are interested in Haskalah, right, in the Enlightenment and in this new kind of Jewish literature and poetry, they like him. Everybody likes him. Doesn't do him any good during life, but everybody likes him after death. And he writes this incredible, incredible book called Mesilat Yesharim. I just reread it this year after many years of not having looked at it. And it's an incredible book, not because of its piety, right? And he's clearly a very, very pious man. I'm going to answer the question I saw in a second. But because he's so real, he's so not fake. He understands how hard it is to be a humble person, how hard it is to be a good person. And he grapples with that. He's very, very, very real. And we're going to read the introduction to the book in a minute. But I just thought, where did the Jews flee to in 1291 if they were able to get away, right? Which is not necessarily possible, but they went to places that did still have Jewish communities. Last week we talked about Tzfat, right? So Tzfat is being rebuilt by Baibars, okay? And other places that are now freed from the Crusaders, right? Jews can go back to Jerusalem. They can go back to Hebron, right? So that's also possible that they went. But how long did they stick around when the city is already being attacked by the Mamluks? That's an interesting question. Right, the Ramban is already dead by 1267, Rabbi Chil of Paris as well, I believe. So the community kind of is falling apart already before the Mamluks arrive. Okay, let's take a look at what the Ramchal writes in the introduction to the Path of the Just, the Misilat Yesharim. A consideration of the general state of affairs will reveal that the majority of men of quick intelligence and keen mentality devote most of their thought and speculation to the subtleties of wisdom and the profundities of analysis, each according to the inclination of his intelligence and his natural bent. There are few, however, who devote thought and study to perfection of divine service, to love, fear, communion, and all the other aspects of saintliness. It is not that they consider this knowledge essential. If questioned, each would maintain it is of paramount importance. Their failure to devote more attention to it stems rather from its being so manifest and so obvious to them that they see no need for spending much time on it. Consequently, this study and reading of works of this kind have been left to those of a not too sensitive, almost dull intelligence, right? So the smart people don't study ethics and Mussar because it's obvious. So who's stuck studying ethics and Mussar? The dummies. These you will see immersed in the study of saintliness, not stirring from it. This state of affairs results in evil consequences, both for those who possess wisdom and for those who do not, causing both sides to lack true saintliness and rendering it extremely rare. The wise lack it because of their limited consideration of it, and the unwise because of their limited grasp. The result is that saintliness is construed by most to consist in the recitation of many psalms, very long confessions, difficult fasts, ablutions in ice and snow, all of which are incompatible with intellect and which reason cannot accept. And if this has hooked you on the Misilat Yesharim, go out, dig up your copy, and sit and learn at this Shabbos. Okay. But Ramchal is an opening for us to come back to women. Okay. This is the Beit Knesset of the Ramchal. It is deep in the old city of Akko, down winding alleyways. It has just received a facelift and a new visitor center, which is very good news because it really is a beautiful, small Beit Knesset. It may not be the original one, but there is the Sefer Torah, is the original Sefer Torah from the Ramchal. And as you can see, it's rather strange looking. It's colored that way, not because of age, but because it's written on deer skin with ink made out of pomegranate juice, which is really unusual and really interesting. It's clearly a kosher Sefer Torah. So no problem with doing that, but most people did not do that. It is a synagogue that does not have a bima, doesn't have a high place. It has a hole in the floor where people daven from, a little like the Altnai Shul in Prague. It is the only functioning shul in the old city today. And it does not have a women's section. It does not have a women's section. Whether this is because of Kabbalah, women shouldn't be in the synagogue with men, or because of practical considerations, unclear. But it leads us, is a nice intro into, did women go to the synagogue, right? Very interesting question. We have testimony in different directions, whether women went to the synagogue or not. I brought you some testimony here that does seem to indicate that they did go to the synagogue. But does that mean that most women did, or these are the unusual ones? It's an interesting question, right? But we have a couple of our sources. We have a couple of Christian sources, right? So take a look in the Gemara and Sota. A certain widow in whose neighborhood there was a synagogue, and despite this every day, she went and prayed in the study hall of Rabbi Yochanan. Right, this takes us back to last week when we talked about should you pray in the Beit Midrash or the Beit Knesset. Rabbi Yochanan said to her, "My daughter, is there not a synagogue in your neighborhood?" She said to him, "My teacher, don't I attain a reward for all the steps I take while walking to pray in the distant study hall?" So notice Rabbi Yochanan doesn't say to her, "Why are you coming to the synagogue? You don't have to do that." He says, "Why are you coming to this synagogue?" Right? Assuming she would come to one, and she says, "Scarpsiot," right? I wanna walk more and get more reward. The very, very famous story about Rabbi Meir. who would preach in his synagogue of Hamat, and a woman would come, and she would stay late, and her husband was very angry, right? It's a very, very familiar story, but it shows that she would come and listen to him every Friday night, okay? Now, it could be that these stories are told because they're unusual, because most women did not do that, but it could be that they are the norm. And we have two different statements here from the New Testament. Take them as you will, but we could say it's Messiah Lefi Tumo. The New Testament is not, doesn't have any campaign, polemic to show that women prayed, right? It just happens to be that they're mentioning on the Sabbath day, we went through the gate by the riverside where it seemed likely there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and spoke to the women, which were come together, right? They came to the place of prayer by the river. Okay. And again, this is all happening in Chutzlaretz, by the way, these stories from the New Testament. Now, when they had passed through Amphipolis, they went to Apollonis and then to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Right. And Paul is preaching, blah, blah, blah. And some of them were persuaded, and women of the first rank, not a few. Okay. We also have an inscription that talks about a woman donor to the synagogue and how she can sit in the front row, which is going to bring us to our last topic about women, which is, did they sit separately or not? But we certainly have enough testimony here to indicate that at least some women in ancient times did go to the Beit Knesset. They weren't kept outside. Did they go, or is it, you know, today, how many young mothers are able to go to synagogue on a regular basis, right? So duties of the home were definitely very, very pressing, but it doesn't mean that women couldn't go. And it's interesting, by the way, that in the first story here, it's a widow. Okay, she doesn't have responsibilities at home, presumably. And in the second story, it's a woman who gets in big trouble with her husband. So how compatible is synagogue going with having a family? Interesting question. Okay, so a little bit more about Akko. The ruler in Ottoman times who makes Akko great is this guy named Ahmed Pasha al-Jazar. Al-Jazar means the butcher. He was not a particularly pleasant person. He was known for cutting off limbs of all sorts of people, but he did make Akko great again. And he built the largest mosque in the land of Israel, except for the one in Jerusalem. And he kept the city very strong. And his royal advisor, his greatest advisor, was a Jew whose name was Chaim Farchi. Chaim Farchi is very involved in the battle against Napoleon. Okay, Napoleon conquers Egypt and then starts to make his way up the coast, conquering one city after another. He gets to Jaffa, he gets to Caesarea, okay? And then he comes to Akko. Well, he passes Caesarea. There's nothing in Caesarea, but he comes to Akko, and he wants to conquer Akko and continue on to Turkey. He wants to conquer the whole world. He speaks to Chaim Farchi. He says, listen, I'm going to be good for the Jews. You should help me. But Chaim Farchi is loyal to Al-Jazar, and a coalition of the Ottomans and the British with Admiral Sidney Smith managed to defeat Napoleon and to get rid of him. A very interesting bystander to this story is Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who's a 26-year-old young man who has come on his one visit to the land of Israel, and he's lucky enough that he's there at the time that Napoleon is attacking on the sea, and he's terrified of all the battles. He can't wait to get out of there. He finally manages to book passage on a ship leaving Akko. He sees it's full of cannons. It's a warship. And he and his servant, they go and they hide in the berth of the ship. He writes about all this. He writes how the one of the porters on the ship felt bad for them and had pity on them and gave them some coffee. Okay. But he manages to get out of the land of Israel and to return to Eastern Europe. But Rabbi Nachman is there. Hey, the Ottomans build up the city. They build a beautiful, beautiful bathhouse, a number of bathhouses, and they build a very frightening prison in which are imprisoned, among others, one of the major leaders of the Baha'i religion, the Baha'u'llah, who actually dies in the prison. This is a very important Baha'i prophet. The British later take over the prison, and we're going to go quickly through this because I really want to get to our last story about women. But the British take over the prison. It becomes an infamous prison in the time of the underground movements of the Jews fighting against the British. One of the most famous prisoners in the prison is Zev Jabotinsky, the head of the revisionist movement, who's only there for a very, very short time. He actually turns himself into the British because he organizes Jewish self-defense in 1920. against Arab riots. The British arrest all sorts of Jews, and Jabotinsky shows up at the police station. He says, in Jerusalem, he says, if you're going to arrest them, arrest me. I was in charge. And they, you know, have no problem complying, and they arrest him. And then he's sent from prison to prison. He ends up in Akko, where he becomes a real celebrity. He lectures. People come to hear him. There's so much public pressure that eventually the British release him after only 3 months. But the British continue to imprison Jews in Akko, and it's the place where they execute Jews because it's very far away. They assume that because it's an Arab city by this point, right, by the 1940s, it will make less of a you know, big noise than if they were to do it in Jerusalem. And so they famously execute 7 members of the underground movement between April and July 1947. An 8th one was already executed in 1938. And this is a very, very terrible story. The 7 are buried actually in Tzfat, the Olei HaGardom, in the prison in Akko, which today is a tourist site. The room of the Gardom, the room of the Gallows, has a memorial to these Olei HaGardom, to these 8 Jews who were executed here. And of course, the prison is super famous for the prison break, which happens here. Prison break, May 4th, 1947. The goal was not only to get Jews out so they can continue to fight for independence, but to embarrass the British. And it really was terribly embarrassing because here's this prison, which is supposed to be impenetrable, and it's so powerful. And yet the Jews managed to get out. They explode a hole in the wall of the prison, and they jump out. The closest building to the prison where they jumped out is actually the bathhouse. And they jump onto the roof of the bathhouse, which breaks, and they fall into the bathhouse, which was having Women's Day at the time. Quite a surprise for the women who are assembled there. Okay, last 2 things we're going to talk about, and that's the Tunisian synagogue. Tunisian synagogue is the work of one very, very dedicated man who passed away a couple of years ago, Mar Eliyahu Badash, who came to Akko in the 1940s and made it his life's work to create a synagogue that is covered top to bottom in mosaics, tons and tons and tons of incredibly beautiful mosaics, not made by him. He is the brains behind it, but commissioned by him and made by a place called Kibbutz Elon. And there are mosaics in the Beit Midrash on the bottom. There are mosaics in the stairwell. There are mosaics in the main sanctuary. And there are mosaics, like we said, in the women's section, already incredible, right? Encompassing everything from maps to ancient coins to people from Tanakh, and very interesting imagery, which we're going to talk about next time, right? What do we say about imagery in the Beit Knesset? He has people in the main sanctuary, but they are people that do not have features on their faces. So that's his kind of a compromise. But it's a fascinating, fascinating place. These pictures do not do it justice. But we will finish briefly by asking the question of, was there a women's section in ancient synagogues? Okay. Now, it's a very interesting question because archaeologically, we have no physical evidence of women's section in ancient synagogues. There's a little bit, perhaps, of a possibility of a second floor in certain synagogues, like in Susia or in Beit Alpha, but there's no proof that these are used for women. We have no inscriptions that talk about a women's section, even though lots of other places are mentioned, right? So-and-so who gave the money to redo the mosaic, to redo the mikvah. Nobody talks about redoing the women's section. And the rabbis, perhaps more importantly, we have no halachot about a women's section, how it should look, where it should be, what it should face. We have halachot about everything else in the Beit Knesset, but nothing about a women's section. We do have a mention of a women's section, but it's a very temporary one, right? The Mishnah and the Gemara and Sukkah talk about Simchat Beit HaShoevah and Chol Moed Sukkot. You have this fabulous celebration, right, where you have jugglers and you have music and you have dancing and you have party, right? And what would they do then? they would make a balcony in the women's court. Throughout the year, the women's court was for women and men. Okay, but take a look here in the Gemara and Sukkah. What is this significant repair? Rabbi Elazar said it is like that which we learned, surrounding the courtyard with a balcony, a gezuztra, and the women should sit above and the men below, right? And then you have a discussion, should the women be on the top, on the bottom, the inside, the outside, right? But the idea was that when there's all this partying going on, inappropriate that the women and the men should be together. But if they're separated on Simchat Beit HaShoeivah, mashma, they're together all of the rest of the time. Okay, we have a Tosefta here, Masechet Erechin, that even talks about women who are in the Azara, not only in the Ezrat Nashim. Le'olam lo nir'et isha ba'azara, ela b'sha'at korbanal bilvad. There's an opinion that a woman can come into the Azara to put her hands, do smicha on the korban. So not only is she not restricted to the women's court, she could even come into the Azara. And we have one reference to a separation between men and women. It's not in a synagogue, right? It seems to be on a social occasion. In Kiddushim, Rabbi Kahana said, if there are men without and women within, we have no fear of privacy, right? We're not worried about yichud. We're not worried that the women will be alone with the men. If there are men in the inner chamber and women in the outer, we are worried about this, right? And Braita, the reverse was taught. So Abaye said, now that Rabbi Kahana has ruled thus, while the Braita taught the reverse, let us act stringently. Abaye made a partition of jugs. Rabbi made a partition of canes. But again, this is happening at a social occasion, not in a synagogue. In reality, we have no mention or physical evidence of a mechitza until the Middle Ages. Cairo Geniza in the 11th century talks about it. We find it in late medieval synagogues. We don't have it before that. So, does not seem that in ancient times there were women's sections as we understand them today. Could this be because women did not go to the Beit Knesset? Again, possible, although we've seen that at least some women did. Okay, let me go back and see if there are questions we did not answer. Sorry, I went a little over time. If one is to interpret the obligations women have at the start of Shabbat, that's about women and time. Like I said, we're not going to go into it too much. Okay. I think that is all we have here. Revealing the New York Times back in 1947 used the term Zionist terrorists. That's not very surprising. Describe those who attacked the British in Akko. Today they are called militants. Yes, we love the New York Times. Is it proven that families were not sitting together? No. We have no idea if families were sitting together. Maybe the women were mixed within the room in a certain area without a permanent wall. Again, all open to discussion. We have, as of yet, no proof. Okay. Absence of evidence on separation laws could indicate there was no separation. Yes. Although, again, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, as we say in Tanakh things, but still. There so far is no concrete evidence. Rabbi Yosef Karo authored the Magid Mishnah as a commentary on the Rambam. He wrote Megan Meisharim based on the talks we had with the angel. Thank you for clarifying. Who is that? Thank you, Saul, for clarifying. Next week we are back to regular scheduled time. Maya, do you have anything you need to add? Thank you, everyone. Maya?
Hi, thanks so much, Julie. It was a really, really incredible class. Can everyone hear me? All good?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. I'm going to leave the class open for another 10 minutes just in case people didn't hear about the time change and want to show up. And real quick, this coming week, we have tonight our weekly Parshat HaShavua with special guest speaker. I believe it is Rabbi Daniel Friedman. So that's tonight at 8:30. Tomorrow morning, we have Rabbi Kalman's recurring class, A Closer Look at the Siddur, Part 39. And of course, you won't want to miss on Sunday morning at 11:15 Eastern, we have Rabbi Leaptag's Part 2 of his Sefer Yirmiyahu class, When Politics and Religion Clash. So those will all be really great. But thank you to Shuli for an amazing class today.
And okay. Thank you, Maya. Thank you, everybody. Shabbat Shalom. Next week, back to 7 p.m., 12 p.m. Israel time.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Maya, you made yourself host again. Okay. So I can leave without any consequences.
What city are we doing next week?
Thanks.
Next week, we are going to the Golan. It's nice and cool there. We'll have some wine. Okay. Bye, everybody.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.